Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello, and welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy at the U.S. Army War College and the editor of A Better Peace. Thanks for joining us for today's podcast. If you are a watcher of both or either military and entertainment news, you might have seen that a Top Gun remake is in the works. And whether the prospect of this delights you or terrifies you or disappoints you, it's big news and likely big money. So from iconic 1980s films such as Top Gun or the Army's version Stripes to more contemporary depictions of life in the U.S. military or of war and combat, say in the action movie like 2012's Battleship, the relationship between the U.S. military and the U.S. entertainment industry is an important and interesting one. But this relationship is one that emerges and evolves over time, and it really goes back to the early part of the 20th century. So on today's podcast, we're going to take a historical look at the U.S. Navy's relationship to Hollywood in the 20s and 30s as a way to better contextualize and think about the contemporary relationship between the U.S. military and the entertainment industry, which we might expand to include film, television, and sports. Our guest expert today is Dr. Ryan Wadley, who directs the research program at the E-School of Graduate PME for Air University in Montgomery, Alabama, and he will have a book on this topic forthcoming with the University of Oklahoma Press in the spring of 2019 called Selling Sea Power, Public Relations and the U.S. Navy, 1917 to 1941. So, Ryan, welcome to A Better Peace.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, Ryan, I'm going to start with a pretty broad question, which is, why does the Navy or any other military service, for that matter, have a relationship to Hollywood or the entertainment industry in the first place? What are they trying to do?
So, you know, the main reason why you see, you know, the Navy and the other services, you know, build a relationship with Hollywood is, you know, there is a public information function that's part of this. You know, the Navy has a responsibility to defend the national interest, a responsibility, you know, as an organization to defend the Constitution, but there's also a responsibility to the people. And so, you know, for people who get, you know, news, information, entertained by Hollywood, there is a way of informing the public through mass entertainments, and so the services have largely bought into that rationale for most of the last century.
Great. So, it sounds like it's almost another element of a civil-military relationship that we could talk about, or even in the Navy's interest or the military service's interest, to make sure that maybe information that's being put out about the military is correct.
Yes. Yeah, and so, in fact, so one of the big drivers for why the Navy starts interacting with Hollywood, at least in a formalized way, starting in 1929, is there's a big concern that the public will, you know, if they're not having some kind of interaction or oversight or are able to insert themselves into the production process for these films, the public may not get an accurate representation of what the Navy is, what the Navy does, what the Navy can do.
Right, in part because the military is going to be separate from the rest of society, and the Navy maybe even more so than the other services.
Yeah, and that's a big problem that the Navy is always very acutely concerned about is, you know, historically, you know, the Navy, up until the 1890s, really, you know, the Navy was primarily known for squadron service overseas. You would be away from the country for long stretches. You know, even the ships that are stationed in the United States may only be concentrated in a few port cities. And so one of the challenges that the Navy has in the 1890s as they're trying to build a larger force is trying to explain what they do to a public, for the most part, that didn't really have any contact with the Navy, didn't really have any knowledge with the Navy. And so, like, for instance, one thing that the Navy does to build up a relationship with a larger swath of the country is they build the Great Lakes Naval Training Center, which is just north of Chicago, and that opens up around the turn of the century, 1900. And one of the Navy's justifications for this is Midwesterners know nothing of the service.
Middle America needs a Navy
too.
So I think that's really interesting, but it also suggests that the Navy feels like Hollywood and the entertainment industry can give it something that its own public affairs, that its own sort of PR internal people can't do for them. So what is it that they think Hollywood and the sort of entertainment industry is going to offer?
Well, I think, you know, I can look at this historically and we can talk about this in a present context. I think the way the historical relationship evolves is the Navy, you know, the Navy public affairs for most of the interwar period is roughly three officers, a civilian aide, and a Marine orderly. And so the entire public affairs...
That's very small.
Yes, yes. Okay. Now, granted, the Navy at the time was only about 86,000 officers and men, so not a very big service, so roughly about, you know, a third to a quarter of what the modern Navy is today. But there's only so much they can do. There was a method through which they could distribute information through different bureaucracies that kind of falls apart after a while. And so one of the things that I think is kind of an unspoken subtext in when this relationship really becomes formalized in the late 20s is, you know, the Navy's trying to figure out how can you expand your reach with only a small number of people really devoted to this kind of work.
And maybe the answer is like it is now, with you can do that with other people's money,
mm-hmm.
time, resources, and talent. And
yeah.
So if you can get somebody else to do it for you.
Yes, essentially, yeah. And in all of the agreements that they forge with the studios for these individual films, at no point is the Navy supposed to be paying for any of this.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned the sort of formalization of this relationship in the 20s. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that formalized relationship actually looks like? How does this work?
Sure. So the Navy had, you know, interacted with the film studios, or what becomes the film studios. The film industry goes through a fairly marked period of change. You have a bunch of very small outfits in the early 20th century. Then they eventually come together in a larger conglomeration that's usually referred to nowadays as the Trust. And so they had tried to build a monopoly on film equipment, film production. That eventually gets torn apart through court cases. And so you get the rise of modern studios starting in the 19-teens. The first one that emerges is Paramount under Zukor. And then within a few years, you get Warner Brothers, you get MGM, you get Fox. Fox has kind of a weird business model. There's also Columbia. And so what they call the Big Five emerge by about the mid-1920s. Some are a little more successful than others. Paramount and MGM are the biggest of the two, or the biggest of the five. And so there's a period of evolution going on there. And so as these studios are rising up, so from the Navy's perspective, when especially during the Trust days, they would get requests to aid in production of films. Usually they came in here and there. The Navy did have a very broad policy that was spelled out during Josephus Daniels' tenure as Secretary of the Navy. He's the Secretary of the Navy under Woodrow Wilson, so from 1913-1921. But one of the things that happens is when World War One comes along, there's an overriding concern for security. And so even though the Navy actually steps up and creates its first public affairs organization during the war, there's this almost blanket prohibition on collaborating with the film studios during the war.
Okay.
And so then after the war, you have a few onesie-twosie kind of incidents, but for the most part, there's not really much of an informational entertainment relationship. They still have a fairly strong business relationship. The Navy creates the Motion Picture Exchange, which is a way of buying Hollywood films to then send out for entertainment to the fleet. Yeah, and there's all sorts of rules with that, but it's a fairly lucrative relationship. The studios view this as a way for like easy publicity and building up their market share. You know, the Navy's just happy that they've got one more way to entertain the sailors while they're aboard ship and off doing other things.
So they have an existing relationship in some ways, but this develops over time, and it's also what in hindsight we're going to call the interwar period, and a period of rapid development for the Navy as well.
Yeah, and so in the mid 1920s, so the Navy's actually not in the best shape, in a lot of ways during the mid 1920s. After the Washington Conference, you know, Congress is very reluctant to spend any money on naval construction.
The Washington Conference is the one that basically limits.
Yes, naval arms limitation.
Size of,
yes,
of the Navy.
Yeah, so there's the famous 5-5-3 ratio. So Britain and the United States were supposed to be supposed to have naval parity. The Japanese have a 60% fleet, 60% the size of the United States, and so the Navy. Yeah, so the Navy has, it feels like they're in poor standing. But then Hollywood, they start making a bunch of films about World War One and the military that are making money. There's The Big Parade, What Price Glory. One of the films that comes out, it's very small, it's called The Midshipman. It's filmed at Annapolis. The Navy actually allows the actor in the film, Ramon Navarro, to participate in graduation ceremonies, which may sound really weird. Nowadays, but it made a decent amount of money. There's other films, smaller, more modest films. And so Hollywood sees this as, hey, we can make money off of these films. And so they start submitting more requests for assistance to the Navy. And so finally, after a few years, it becomes, they're getting enough requests where the Navy feels like they need to do something about this. And so in early 1929, the Navy creates what's called the Motion Picture Board. And so it has the heads of the information section of the Office of Naval Intelligence. That's the PR office. Yes, they were part of Naval Intelligence. That's a whole other story.
Right.
The head of the Recruiting Bureau, and there's a few other officers involved. And then the orders will be amended a couple of times. But this Motion Picture Board is responsible for managing the Navy's relationship with Hollywood from 1929 up until the war starts.
Okay. And they're managing things like access.
Yes. Yeah. So the way the process would work is they would ask the studios. They would submit like a script. Sometimes the studios wouldn't submit like a full script, but they would submit like a story idea. They would review it. They would send comments back. And so you may get a response of, yeah, you make these couple of minor changes. We'll do this. They may ask for like a larger scale revision, or they may send back a flat refusal, and they may go into reasons why. So mm-hmm. whether or not it's, they don't want to, the Navy at times, insisted that they shouldn't, their ships should not be representing foreign ships. And so you'll see projects rejected because they want a U.S. ship to look like a German ship from World War One. Or they may say this thing is just so antithetical to naval customs that we should just not.
Support it. Can't attach our name to it in any way.
Yeah, not even entertain this. So the more interesting ones are when you see them, see the films where the Navy wants changes and then is working through the process because after the script is approved, they will then participate with production. They may or may not assign a technical advisor. For a while, the Navy was reluctant to do this. This becomes more commonplace, though, by the late 1930s. And then when the film is complete, the completed print will then be sent to the Navy Department for review, and then they will give their blessing whether or not it should be released.
So sort of we can see a negotiation and a back and forth mm-hmm. and some cooperation.
Sure.
But can you talk to us a little bit about how this relationship creates challenges or friction? Where do we see divergent interests, say, for the Navy and Hollywood?
Sure. So one thing that the Navy is always concerned with is security. In fact, the stated public affairs policy or public relations, they didn't call it, public affairs is the term that really only emerges after World War II. The state of policy during most of the interwar period is the Navy should release all information not incompatible with military secrecy. And so, but when you start butting up against anything that appears to be secret,
mm-hmm.
Then the Navy gets concerned. And so the top gun of its day is a film called Helldivers. It's released in very late 1931. The production process is very instructive because, one of the very common concerns the Navy would have in film scripts is how sailors are being represented. And so during the script review process, the main thing the Motion Picture Board is concerned with is the protagonist of the film to use a modern analogy, imagine if Goose was a drunken burnout.
Okay. That would change the whole film.
Yes.
But...
Yes. Yes. Okay. Imagine Top Gun being built around Goose, and Goose is a drunken burnout. That's kind of what Windy is. He's played by Wallace Beery, who was also a naval reservist, ironically enough. And so the Navy's concerned with how Windy's being portrayed, and so there's all sorts of adjustments that they ask to be made to the script. Like, for instance, he shouldn't be borrowing money from his commanding officer. You know, we would rather not see that. And so the Navy eventually gets around some of these things. They basically say, you know, it's fine that Windy is still kind of rough around the edges. Well, we just need to make it clear in the film that he's an exception. You know, he's mm-hmm. not standard, you know, and he does at times face consequences for his actions. But then when the film comes out, the Navy, the emphasis shifts, because as soon as they see everything that's been put on screen, the Navy's suddenly concerned with, uh-oh, the British and the Japanese may now understand how we operate, how deck operations work on our latest aircraft carriers, and they may be able to learn something from this movie.
Okay.
And so the short-range solution to this is they put in a black bar, so this way you cannot see... an arresting hook come down from the aircraft as they're landing on the carrier. And so when you're watching the film, you will just see this little black thing just emerge from the bottom of the screen. But then there's like a 2 or 3 year battle where they're trying to figure out what happened to all of the footage that was shot, but then never edited into the film.
Ends up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. And so they find like 40 some reels of film, somewhere basically in the MGM basement. Yeah.
And I imagine this is not a problem that goes away, right?
Yeah.
If one of the things you want to do is to put out accurate information about the U.S. military, about the Navy, about life in the military, or whatever it is, and at the same time you want to protect sort of operating procedures, technological, you know, proprietary technology,
mm-hmm.
And maintain that competitive advantage, you have a real tension.
Yeah.
There is there a way that those tensions tend to be resolved in this period? Does it sort of fall on one side or the other?
Not really. I mean, so you will see at times people use different incidents that they were not fans of as evidence of, you know, perhaps we should rethink this relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, and so for instance, in 1935, when Warner Brothers starts working on a submarine movie, Admiral Joseph Mason Reeves, who at the time is the commander of the fleet, he was previously one of the Navy's first carrier, the Navy's first carrier commander. And so he cites Helldivers as a reason why you should not assist with this submarine movie, because essentially the Japanese may have learned a lot from this. By the way, Helldivers screened in Japan. Apparently the Japanese loved it. And the Navy also found out at some point the Germans kept trying to get a hold of copies of the film, so this way they could watch it, even though Germany at the time really wasn't in a position to build aircraft carriers.
Right.
But there was still the concern of this. And so Reeves, because of Reeves's complaints, the Navy essentially shuts down any idea of working on that submarine film. Now, Warner Brothers eventually comes back after Reeves leaves, and is able to get that film made, but this one also opens up its own security concerns. The film is called Submarine D1, and it comes out in 1937. But one of the reasons why, from what I can see, that the Navy eventually endorses this film production, they assign a technical advisor. He works through a lot of problems. But the Navy is able to showcase one of its new pieces of submarine rescue equipment in this. The Navy had mm-hmm. some horrible submarine accidents, you know, lost entire crews in the 1920s. And so as a result, they develop the Mommsen Lung, which is, you know, just a little hood that allows you to escape a downed submarine as long as you're close enough to the surface. They also come up with something called the McCann Rescue Chamber, which is basically a big bell you lower from a ship onto a submarine, you know, and then you bring up men about a half dozen at a time. And so this is new equipment. This is all brand new stuff. The public doesn't really know, or you know, the Navy's tried to publicize this.
And they want to showcase it.
Yeah.
To assure people that if their sons or husbands are serving on submarines,
yeah,
there are plans if something goes wrong. There are ways to mitigate the danger and things like that.
Yeah, and this publicity really comes in handy. So, you know, Submarine D1 comes out in 1937, showcases the McCann Rescue Chamber. 2 years later, in May of 1939, there's the accident of the Squalus. The Squalus is on a test dive off of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Goes down. About half the crew die in the crash, but the other half alive. Well, the submarine rescue buoy makes it to the surface, and so the Navy's able to mobilize all of its salvage equipment, and so the McCann Rescue Chamber rescues the remaining men on the Squalus, and in fact, the Navy gets a lot of hosannas in the media from, you know, publicizing all of this stuff, but then also granting the media a lot of access. In some ways, it's really a sign of just how much Navy public relations has advanced from over the previous two decades.
Right. In your last answer, you also brought up the issue of foreign markets for the film studios. So this, and again, if we think about how these historical trends might sort of continue on even now, certainly the foreign market for American films is going to be a really important consideration for film studios. So can you talk a little bit more about how that plays into decision making?
Sure. So one thing that I found in my research, because I was looking at the three main themes that the Navy really tries to publicize in the 1930s. And so that was, technology. Not only can the Navy innovate advanced technology, but is that technology safe for its operators? A favorable image of sailors for recruiting purposes, and then also trying to communicate, the Navy's value to the nation. And so, Hollywood, I think, is really good at helping with those first two things. And that's really, I think, how the Navy views that relationship. They can build an image that the Navy finds acceptable for sailors, that can be used as essentially informal recruiting material. You can showcase your latest technology, even if Helldivers then leads to all sorts of, questions and recriminations and whatnot. But the Navy itself is relatively reluctant to put in an explicit message of preparedness or some kind of national value into these movies. And to be honest, the Hollywood studios are perfectly fine with that because they rely in the 1930s a lot on the foreign market. And so, it's very well known that Hollywood, the sympathies of many people in Hollywood were against, say, like Nazi Germany. But it's not until really late in the 1930s that Hollywood really starts to make a lot of anti-Nazi films.
The political sentiment, especially the international political sentiment, is a relatively minor undercurrent of these discussions and these negotiations.
So for Hollywood, they don't want to be seen to be taking a political stance because they're afraid they won't be able to export these films.
And so, like you said, they're focusing then on showcasing technology and sort of the informal recruiting that might come with showing how interesting or cool or glamorous sailor's life might be. So, Ryan, if we zoom forward, say, to the 21st century, how do you think this historical moment that you've been talking about in the 20s and 30s, how do we see either trend lines continuing or diverging today? What do you think are the questions or considerations that we should be thinking about?
So, the obvious comparison to me is, so when you look at these films coming out in the 1930s, especially the larger, more successful ones, it's not like nowadays where a film opens up in 2,000 or 3,000 screens. Back then you had a few prints but they would sometimes be on the road for months or years. And so, when roughly half the country is going to a film every week, it's a very easy way to get a mass audience to see their Navy at work. Nowadays you don't really have, you've got a lot of changed business circumstances that make this much more difficult. For instance, with Hollywood, the reliance on foreign markets is now a driving concern for Hollywood business. And so you've seen films in recent years that get made largely because of their success in foreign markets, not necessarily because they made any money here. To give one example, there was a sequel to a heist movie called Now You See Me, called Now You See Me 2. The reaction for most people was like, why does this movie even exist? The reason why, the Chinese apparently loved the first movie. And so
there's a whole lot of Chinese people.
Yes. And then you can see kind of political concerns trying to be diffused in this, where, say, like in The Martian, when the Chinese become like one of the reasons for why, you know, Matt Damon's character, spoiler, survives the movie, or, you know, or the fact that in the film, you know, Black Hat, which is supposed to be like this expose into cyber hacking, you know, the Chinese are working with the Americans to stop this essentially cyber terrorist. And so they're really trying to just placate, you know, the foreign market, because there's a lot of money to be made.
Sure.
In Chinese theaters. So you've got the political concerns, you know, when you're looking at, but when you're looking at these different forms of media, you know, Hollywood really plays right now to blockbusters, you know, and so properties that have some kind of existing brand equity. And so that's why you have comic book films or films right. based on video games or amusement park rides.
So, I mean, so Hollywood has changed
yes.
a lot.
Yes.
The military has also changed a lot. Right?
Yeah, and so the kinds of films that, in theory, these Navy films would have been in the 1930s would be like middlebrow films, which, you know, in the last 20 years have really kind of hollowed out. And so a lot of people have argued that the reason why television has gotten so good over the last 20 or 30 years with things like The Sopranos, The Wire, things like that, is the middlebrow market in Hollywood has really been mm-hmm. hollowed out. And so stories that would have been like a 2-hour movie in 1990, you know, are now turning into like a 10-episode, 5-season show right. on Netflix or FX.
So does the military still have these relationships with the entertainment industry?
So they do. In fact, a recent graduate of our program, she works at the Hollywood Liaison Office for the Air Force out in California, and so she gave me some information on how things work now. They do a lot of stuff with television, you know, but television's its own story where everyone watches, or a lot of people watch TV, you know, there's cord cutting and things like that, you know, so even television is changing, but you know, even trying to use television nowadays as a way of getting, you know, some kind of message out for the Navy is much more problematic because, you know, just the proliferation of channels.
Right.
And
there's so many options.
Yes. And so, yeah, so a show that would have gotten, you know, say 15 million viewers in, say, like the late 1970s, early 80s, that show probably would have been canceled because you lost too much of your market share. Nowadays, if you have a show that gets 15 million viewers per episode, that's Walking Dead territory at its peak, and that's the reason why that show was such a phenomenon. It was one of the few, like, tentpole shows, that and, Nerds Talking Dirty show.
I have literally no idea what you're talking about.
Big Bang Theory.
Okay.
You can tell I don't watch the show. But yeah, this, you know, those kinds of things are really rare nowadays. And so, you know, I think in some ways trying to, you know, using these mass media, you know, which really evolved, you know, decades ago as a vehicle for getting your message out there, it's become much more difficult and problematic.
Yeah, it strikes me, this is speculative, but that the relationship between the military services and professional sports franchises
yes.
have taken some of the place of this, because professional sports are still maybe one of the only things
mm-hmm.
that draws a live
yeah.
mass media market.
No.
And so with the NFL, NASCAR, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and that's very true. You know, but then you've even seen some pushback against that. You know, there was an expose a few years ago about how, you know, essentially the DOD had paid the NFL
right.
to allow servicemen into games and be publicized there. And so there was pushback against that. There was actually a rather fairly amusing study where for a while, Dale Earnhardt Jr., his car was sponsored by the Army National Guard. And so they did a study trying to figure out, was this actually helping?
Yeah,
yeah, was this helping recruiting?
Yeah,
and
what's the return on investment?
Yeah, and the answer was no. And so there was a decision made to pull all of their advertising from races like that. Yeah, but NASCAR also does, you know, has the whole, you know, we'll have events like honoring servicemen and things
sure.
like that. And so that's, you know, so you still have that kind of informal thing, but the formal relationships that they had tried to use with some of these things really collapsed.
So Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today. That'll wrap up our conversation. We've got lots to think about, lots of questions, and maybe some new films to go watch if we can find them.
Yes, please.
So thanks so much for your time, and good talking to you.
Thank you.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.